Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention to popular automation apps on smartphones. They can be very useful, but they can also be used to track and harass people in domestic abuse situations. What can be done about it? Well, we're going to find out as we talk with two guests for you today. With us, Kasam Fawaz, an associate professor and associate chair for research for the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department at UW-Madison. Kasam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also in the studio with me, Rahul Chatterjee is an associate professor of computer science at UW-Madison. He runs the Madison Tech Clinic, which supports survivors of domestic and intimate partner violence. Rahul, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Larry.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. What do you want to know about security issues related to automation apps? Has someone hacked into your phone maybe and harassed you or given you some problems? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Raul, let's start with you. You're heavily involved with the Madison Tech Clinic. You oversee it, as a matter of fact. Let's talk about what it is and what it does.
Yeah, so I created Madison Tech Clinic when I moved here right before COVID. I sent a cold email to Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, DAIS, which is the largest domestic violence support service here, to about technology abuse. I have been doing that work during my PhD, and I want to continue here. And then COVID happened, no much communication. And then long after nearly 9 or 10 months, they responded like, we are excited, we want to partner, we want to do something. So, and that's when around 2021, I created this Madison Tech Clinic. The goal was to, that technology is so much intertwined with our life. It's great, it helps us in many ways, but it can be also abused. And one of the biggest challenges when a domestic violence situation, a domestic partner is abusing, all the technology you have built are assuming that that they are safe against someone probably far away land, but we did not consider the threat of a domestic violence situation. So that's where we created, understand about these challenges, we created some protocols, and the goal was, if the domestic violence survivors are, and it is very frequent, over 90% of the cases, we see technology is being used as a mean for spying and harassing survivors. So this clinic, survivors come, talk to us, and we kind of help them create this online safety and technology safety so that they can continue using technology like everyone else. And we are now working with lots of partners all around Wisconsin. So there is a in-person clients, survivors can talk to us in Madison, but if they're far away, they can also call us in. We do this consultation over Zoom. We scan their devices. We understand their technology profile and then help them safety plan.
Wow. So what kind of, maybe Kasam, I'll ask you, what kind of information can be assessed by someone through an automation app? And maybe, you know, is where what is an automation app? Let's get that out of the way, too.
Oh, that's a great question. An automation app is this sort of a platform that allows you to do if then else. People are very busy and they don't want to be reminded to do everything. So what they want to do is, when I check in my apartment, I want the thing to happen. When I wake up, I want that thing to happen. When I'm visiting that location, I want something else to happen. So for this to happen, this automation app needs to know some information and it needs to do some actions. Now, of course, if you trust the automation app, that should be okay. But if someone wants to know your location or wants to read your email or wants to read your messages, they can set up these automation recipes or automation shortcuts, and they can get access to that kind of information right away. For example, a benign or a good shortcut would be, if I'm visiting that location, I want, for example, to turn on an alarm, for example. when an attacker can flip this and can flip this automation right away. When I wake up, I want this location to be sent to this number, mm-hmm. which means that whoever owns that number will get the location of the victim. And that's not something that the designers of these automations have anticipated. That's not something the actual user has anticipated. And if somebody, and Rahul can talk more into this because they have seen that in practice, if somebody wants to scan the phone and see what's going on, it's very hard to detect these things without some technical ability.
Oh, and Rahul, I remember reading somewhere that you learned that a client's cell phone was being controlled by their domestic abuser. How did you learn that?
It's pretty frequent in our clinic when we talk to the clients. We look at many types of compromise. Like one of the things is like in domestic relationship, it's very normal people to share devices, share passwords, share accounts. And that's completely fine until it is in the situation of domestic violence where the same access can be used to spy or harass. So in one of our cases, without going into details, it was more on someone was using this automation app to harass the survivor. They were closing certain applications, preventing them from using their phone normally. And it was pretty surprising for me because I have not thought about automation. I've been working on this field a long time. I did not think about automation. I'm also not an iPhone user, so I just did not come across that often.
Well, Kasem, are you an iPhone user?
No.
Oh, I'm laughing, but it's not a laughable situation in a way, but... think about iPhones. They pride the company, just prides itself on its security and all that.
That's true. It's not technically a security vulnerability in iPhone per se. It's just an abused property. Like any technology can have good uses, we like them, but they can be abused to do something bad. And this is not just an iPhone problem. There are automation platforms that do exist on Android. They do exist on Pixel. They do exist on Samsung devices. For example, Samsung devices have Bixby routines. They have very similar problems. You have Tasker on Android, also has very similar problems. So it's not just an iPhone problem, really.
Well, so how vulnerable are we? How is anyone for this?
So you need a physical access to the device to install or configure these shortcuts or automation recipes, we call. So shortcuts is a default application in all iPhone. You can delete the app, but it's pre-installed in phones. And the automations we call recipes. So someone needs to physical access to your phone, physically unlocked access to your phone, to be able to install these recipes. So in that way, if you keep your phone locked and close to you, it's okay. But as I mentioned before, in domestic relationship, that's not what we do. And it's fine to share devices and accounts. It's just when it is a new attack vector that survivors of domestic violence have to consider that if they have shared their devices or if their partner had access to the devices, we need to check one more thing now.
Yeah. We were just listening the hour before. They were talking about people. Often divorce came into the conversation. And I can imagine having, your wife or your husband, their access. And I guess it's fine while they're together. But then when they aren't together, Kasem, then it's pretty easy for the other person to gain control, I would guess.
Yes, that's very true. A fundamental concept that we teach in security research and we practice in security research is trust. Any security system, any security property has to be built on a basis of trust. In relationships, the trust means that whoever gets access to my devices are trustworthy. They're gonna use them in a benign way, and they're not gonna be posing any harm to me. When this relationship stops becoming a trustworthy or trusted relationship, then that trust assumption breaks. And when that trust assumption breaks, then everything can go like everything can go haywire. A person who had access to my device could have configured lots of things on my device. If I'm not very technically savvy, it's going to be very hard for me to detect them. And automations are particularly hard, and Rahul can also talk about this a little bit more. When you want to look about things that are happening on your phone, you just look at the applications. Well, these are the apps installed. These are the permissions of the apps. These are the data that these apps have accessed. But automations are not particular apps. They are, in a sense, nano apps or sub apps. You have to look at the automation app, and then you have to dig through the automation app to see all of these recipes, and then you have to dig through each recipe to see what's actually going on. And that's not very easy to do.
Well, when you sign up for, I don't even know how many apps I have on my phone. I mean, it's like pages of apps that are really nice and do a lot of things. But those apps, our apps, they know a lot of things about us that we don't even consider. Because, I mean...
Yeah.
Where we live, where we work.
Yeah.
Where we eat.
I mean, Larry, I'm pretty sure your listeners also wonder the same thing. These are very, very good apps. They're very well developed. And the engineers who develop these apps are paid a lot amount of money. Where does the money come from? Like, these apps are free. We don't pay for them. Where does the money come from? I mean, it's very straightforward. Our data is the money. To be able to get a free app, we have to give up our data. And these apps are very, let's call them curious. They access sensory data. They access data that we upload. They access sometimes data that we do not upload. They process it. They extract lots of features. And these features drive this huge advertisement ecosystem that pays these engineers their money.
and it's done from... These are typically developed, I'm thinking, not for the benefit of the actual end user in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, they are kind of trying to solve some problem of the end user. But yes, they have a motivation behind the scene. The another part, actually, the related thing is many times these apps that we see in domestic violence, these clinics, are not designed for spying or harassing on anyone. I mean, Shortcuts is not designed for spying on someone. It was designed to automate our life. But there is this feature, accidental features they have included in it that can enable stalking. I mean, AirTag is a very good example of that. When Apple created AirTag, it was for item tracking. Great application. I can track my bags through airport. But someone can slip in an AirTag in someone's purse and then track them. Or someone's car and then track the car. So, yes. This is what we call dual-use application or dual-use devices. And that's become a bigger threat in the space that I work on, like this domestic violence and intimate partner violence.
Talking with Qasem Fawaz and Rahul Chatterjee about these apps, and they're great, but they can also be used for nefarious purposes, as we're learning here. And you can join in. We'll give you a chance to do that. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@wpr.org. A couple of emails. Alex emailed, do app designers need to take more responsibility in the design of their apps? Or is the responsibility more on the app user?
I can take that question.
Okay, go ahead, Raul.
And Qasem, you can join in. I think it's the app developers needs to take the responsibility. What we call feature can be abused. So we have been developing this like new way of seeing security and privacy. Security and privacy is not about data or device. It's about human at the end. How the safety at the end impacts the people matters. And that's why when you're developing a feature, it's not about just how good it can be for the society, we have to sit together in a room and then do a safety analysis of those features.
Yeah. Vivian in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. Some friends showed me, I believe, an app on Friday, OneDrive, they open it, and apparently every morning there are pictures from their history, from their past, pictures as old as 50, 60 years ago. He said it was a byproduct of Microsoft 365. I've never heard of that. I don't know if there's a risk. Where are they getting the pictures?
Very interesting, Vivian. Well, Kasem, what about that?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything nefarious going there. This is, I think, is a case of misconfigured permissions. Microsoft 365 is a valid application, and OneDrive is their cloud storage. So when somebody installed Microsoft 365 on their device, they configured OneDrive, and OneDrive asked for permission to access the storage on the device, and someone gave it that access. And then probably there was an option: do you want to back up your device on OneDrive? And that person probably chose yes, I want to back up device, and they gave it permission to access. So OneDrive got access to this data and is showing this data to the user. So this is a case of, again, it's not a malicious app, but it is a misconfigured app, I would say. Rahul, do you think there's anything else we want to add?
No, I think that is true. Probably, did you buy a laptop or a Windows computer recently? And that's probably the reason where you log into your laptop and it will ask for managing everything in your laptop where you probably had the photos which got synced, and now it's showing up on your phone.
Oh, well, I opened up Facebook this morning and I saw a photo of my daughter when she was a memory photo. It was her first day of school when she was 6 years old. And, she's soon to be 22 now, but it popped up and it was a nice thing to see. And then, but you don't think about the fact that, oh, they've been keeping all of that information over a long period of time. Well, I mean, if somebody... Vivian, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. If somebody, how do you know if somebody is actually, I guess you would know if they're blocking access somehow. Your phone suddenly is not working the way it's supposed to work, I guess.
The biggest challenge is that there are so many reasons your phone might not work.
Yeah.
Like there is no signal, there is no battery, somehow it doesn't have enough, memory. And it's very easy to conflate between non-nefarious not working of a phone versus when there is someone is spying or harassing. And we see it very frequently in our cases where the people pick up, like survivors will pick up different parts of things not working or things that may be suspicious and conflate with something that is probably normal, just a non-functioning phone. So, and that is the challenge here. Like, it's very hard to tell. I mean, in this case that I described, in this case, it was clear that something is happening, but it was extremely difficult to find what is causing that thing to happen. There is no notification. I mean, Shortcuts in this is an app that is by default in your phone. It has a very high privilege of permission already accessed, so it can do a lot of things. It does not show any notification, or it can be configured to show no notification. So you don't know what's happening behind the scene.
Kasem, you were at a security conference, gave a paper. What was your research about? Talk about that for a minute.
Well, I was in a conference talking about this paper in particular, describing the automation shortcut. So I want to give a shout out to the lead student on this project, Shirley Zhang. She was taking Rahul's course, and Rahul discussed this problem. She got very interested, and then she pushed through all of this research, and she presented that paper in the conference last week in Seattle. I was just with her along, and there was very good reception about the paper, like people in industry, people in academia, people and even some government researchers were interested in that work.
So what if... how do people, let's put it this way, how does someone protect their phone short of just turning it off and never using it, which is not going to happen? What are the ways that you can kind of protect yourself? Kasem, you want to? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll start and then Rahul can continue because there's a long list of things. I think the first thing is you have to have your phone always up to date. That's a given. You have to have strong passwords for everything. You have to have a strong PIN code for things. And you have to keep revising these pages of applications, Larry, you were talking about. Just make sure every once in a while, see what are the applications doing. Devices have privacy dashboards like Android and iOS. They tell you, well, these apps are the apps that you have. These are the last time they access this kind of data, the access to your microphone, the access to your location. And just make sure that you don't leave them unattended for a long period of time.
Yeah, Raul?
Yeah, I think that those are very good. The only thing I will add is we need to know who are we protecting our data from. At some point of time, I gave up on industry and government. And I protecting my data from them. Instead, I now focused on more imminent threats of this intimate partner violence, where someone close to me can be violent and cause a lot more harm. And in that case, the making sure your phone is locked and almost always in your, you keep it with you, is it goes a long way. So if you can prevent physical access, that prevents a lot of attacks. And the second part is turning on two-factor authentication. It's very simple, and I see so many people don't do that.
I love that. Two-factor.
It's annoying sometimes, but it protects.
Well, you know, when it comes to your bank account and
absolutely
things of that nature, it is very nice to have two-factor.
Yeah. It's not only protects, it also notifies you. It's a way to know if someone is trying to get in.
Johnny Meld, what are the most popular automation apps being used today? Gosh, there's such a variety. But which ones?
I mean, in Apple, the shortcuts. And then for Android, there are Tasker. Fortunately, Tasker is not pre-installed, so you have to install it, and it's not that simple. The UI, I mean, of course, Apple, whenever they do things, they do very well. So they test the shortcuts very well. Tasker requires a lot more technical sophistication to use it. And Samsung has a Bixby routine, which tries to be like an automation app, but its features are so limited. We found that you can hardly do spying with it.
So I want to go back to your organization. You said people can contact your organization no matter where they are, huh?
Yeah.
In the state?
In the state, they can.
Madison Tech
Clinic. Yes.
And if they type that into a search engine, are they going to get some nefarious?
Yeah.
No. If they say Madison Tech Clinic.
Yes. It's a techclinic.cs.wix.edu. We do not directly with clients. We want an advocate. So if you go to nearby domestic violence shelter and let them know, there is a high chance they already know us. If they don't, then ask them to reach out to us. And we will set up. It takes like one day, half an hour to set up a partnership.
But the results are pretty good.
Yeah. We have worked with over 140 clients so far since its inception. This year, it's very busy. This summer, we had 40 clients in last 3-4 months. So
they go. So if somebody is interested, they go to the facility. The social facility they're using.
So nearby domestic violence. So if you're in Madison, we work with almost all domestic violence services in Madison. So you can go any of them and ask for a consultation with us. And they're going to set up one. We're going to go to that location to help because of safety and privacy, all other reasons. If you're remote, you can go to nearby domestic violence shelter and then ask them to set up. So they're going to be there calling in through Zoom to us, and we'll be remotely providing support. There are equations where people still want to come down. So we had, you know, sometimes clients within 2-3 hours driving, they will just come down here. In that case, they will just, we'll host them in our department.
This is really interesting. It's too bad we have to have you guys doing this, to be perfectly honest. I'm really glad you are.
Yeah.
But it's a shame that we have to have people with your expertise and abilities But I'm glad you're there.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much for being with us today. Qasem Fawaz is an associate professor and associate chair for research for electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. And Rahul Chatterjee, assistant professor of computer science at UW-Madison. We should get them back and do this again down the road a little bit. Thank you very much for being with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about alcohol. How much or how little are U.S. adults drinking these days, and what's it like here in Wisconsin? That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. A new Gallup poll says fewer and fewer U.S. adults are drinking alcohol, and for the first time, a majority of Americans believe that even moderate drinking is bad for your health. Do these trends hold true here in Wisconsin? We'll talk about the latest polling data on alcohol consumption with Maureen Buzalaki, who's director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Just a quick note, at noon, the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, returned to talk about the recent flooding in the Milwaukee area, other summer conditions, and U.S. climate change reports. But first, let's talk about alcohol. Do you drink more or less alcohol than you used to? If you're drinking less, tell us why, perhaps. Do you think there's a healthy amount of drinking? Or is there no amount healthy? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Maureen Buzalaki, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's first, before we can get started on this, the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You're the head person there. Tell us about that organization.
Yes, so I'm at MCW in the Comprehensive Injury Center, where we work to reduce injury of all kinds. And alcohol is kind of fuel for that. We find motor vehicle crashes, drownings, railroad crossings, suicide, homicides, and of course, a lot of disease issues in terms of injury and disability that can happen when people are over-consuming.
Wondering about this Gallup poll, I think it was, 54%?
Mm-hmm.
Of you talk about the poll. What are the findings?
Yeah, so this is a national poll by Gallup. I think folks are familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And it does show for 3 years in a row a decrease in self-reported drinking. And this is good news. You know, people are starting to understand that, you know, alcohol is a carcinogen and that, you know, drinking can cause harm, you know, from diseases that can be, you know, by continuing to drink on a regular basis, that can be a real issue, including heart disease, stroke, cancer, those
liver.
Kinds of, yeah, liver disease is a big one. But it's also, there's more what we call acute deaths that happen in terms of alcohol poisoning, crashes, injuries, homicides, suicides, those types of issues as well. And in that combination, it's really, you know, most people aren't probably consuming that much. But in Wisconsin, we tend to consume more than the national average, actually significantly more. So our major focus is on what we call overconsumption or excessive alcohol use. So that's binge drinking, which is 4 to 5 drinks in a single session by men or women. And that means you're at 0.08 for your blood alcohol content. So you're not safe to drive. Then you've got underage drinking, drinking while pregnant, and heavy drinking, which is 1 to 2 a day. So the challenge is figuring out what is that amount, Now, your oncologists and other physicians, especially those treating liver disease, say no amount is safe. The research that has come out has shown that drinking even less than what I just talked about is a really good idea. And, you know, really relooking and understanding what the research shows. So it's probably less than one drink a day for women and one drink or less for men. And try to avoid daily drinking.
I was thinking back to a friend's dad. I didn't drink. He wouldn't go out and drink. But every night he drank a pretty good-sized glass of wine. And he said, well, the doctor said that was good for me.
Right. That's the myth of the red wine study. So that has shown that... I should start at the beginning. A study came out said that drinking red wine was good for your heart. But that's actually not the case. Like I said, alcohol is a carcinogen, and we find that daily drinking is especially bad for our body. And so years later, that report has been debunked. But that's what people thought. The other piece you mentioned is a large glass of wine.
Yeah, it was a pretty good size. I was a kid. I remember, it's a pretty good size glass.
And serving size is really important, too. So it should be 5 ounces in terms of a serving of wine. So if he's drinking more than that, that's more than one serving a day, right? The same thing's true, like with beer, because we have all this kind of more potent beer that's around. Porters and stouts often, have higher alcohol by volume. And that's an issue that you may think you're drinking one, but you're actually drinking two. And then the kind of Elko Pops or those energy drinks, you drink one Four Loko, it has 5 alcohol drinks in one can. So that's
those cans aren't all that big, are they? I mean, that's...
They're bigger, but it's not as
tall
much
and slender.
Liquid, right? And you drink it kind of fast because it's kind of sweet. And that's a real issue in terms of, suddenly you're already at the 0.08 blood alcohol content.
Ellie in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. What's on your mind?
Great. Well, when I heard this topic, it's so relevant to me and my family right now. We live in Wisconsin part-time. We're snowbirds. But I grew up here. And, of course, drinking culture was Wisconsin drinking culture. It is what it is. And it is not like this in any other state I've ever been to. And we are currently in the market for a new home. So we went to a very popular Northwoods Lake, and which we have friends who have homes there. And we went pontooning one day, and we went to a bar because everyone bar hops. And we were looking, and we stopped at a bar, and there was a band. And it was amazing to me how many 30, 40, and 50-year-olds, people in my age bracket, who were not only day drinking tipsy, but they were like smashed drunk, not standing up.
I'm getting the picture here, Ellie. She's making the point that the alcohol culture seems to be ingrained in Wisconsin.
It sure is, Larry. And what we see is this divergence. So we see this larger trend of people drinking less, but we also see other populations drinking as much, if not more. So while our numbers are going down overall, we definitely see people that are, binge drinking, and even we had to make a new category, high-risk drinking, where they're drinking almost double that binge rate. So they're having 8, 9, or 10 drinks in a single.
At a time?
Yes. In a I don't know how many hours, but and that's a real problem because your body does not metabolize alcohol that fast. So what she's describing, I think, is something that we do see in Wisconsin, and that it's socially acceptable at some level to, you know, get that intoxicated.
One piece of news that, or one item from the research that I noted was that among younger people, quite younger people, they're not as inclined to drink or drink as much. And is that correct? And if so, why is that correct?
So our underage drinking and young adult drinking numbers are in decline. However, we're seeing much higher rates of young women and girls drinking than we have in the past. So they're like starting to bridge the gap between, you know, young men and, you know, men overall. So that's quite a disturbing trend. Again, overall, yes, it is going down. But then again, we have this segment of the population that's drinking and drinking more than ever before. We're seeing young women needing liver transplants in their late 20s and 30s, and we never used to see that at that age. You know, that would come later in life. So we are seeing some disturbing trends, even though, like I said, the overall view is changing.
Maureen Bozalaki, our guest today, is director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Questions for her as we talk alcohol use among our population? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, are with us at noon today to talk about climate and weather. Right now, though, we're taking a look at alcohol use in our state and the country, for that matter, with our guest, Maureen Bozalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Joyce in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joyce.
Hello. This is a comment for Maureen, actually. I've been very concerned that our local grocery store suddenly has alcohol islands throughout the store, and it almost normalizes the alcohol as part of grocery shopping. And at one time, liquor sold at a grocery store would be in a corner, and people would have to actually go there to get their liquor. This is bringing the liquor out into the general shopping experience. And I'd like to know if this is something that we are going to have to tolerate, or are there ways in which we can get grocery stores back to being groceries and liquor stores? Liquor sections idealized elsewhere.
Interesting. Thanks, Joyce. Comment, Marie?
Yes. So that's a local decision that's being made. I'm not sure if you're in the city of Madison or, you know, somewhere else in the area, but local alcohol licensing committees and local city councils, village boards, or town boards make that decision as to where alcohol can be sold. And so we recommend, just as you suggest, that you have a separate entrance where you sell the liquor, making sure that you're not getting young people. You don't certainly want anyone to steal anything, you know, and have a secure location for that. That has changed in many communities, not all. And that's something that you can talk to your, you know, local alders or, you know, your town board or village about wanting to change that. That is certainly possible. And we'd be happy to talk to you about it. So you can look us up on the web and we'd be happy to connect.
Joyce, thank you very much for calling. So that's part of your, I mean, your goal is to decrease alcohol consumption, right?
Yes.
That's what you want to do. So, and so you offer solutions or try to offer solutions to help mitigate this. And you just named one.
Yes. So we offer training, technical assistance. We also post, research, both national, state research, research done by our division in order to help inform the public. So anyone who has questions regarding an alcohol policy or things that they could do to reduce alcohol use, we're happy to, sort through the data and share what is evidence-based. So, and what evidence-informed. So what is actually working to reduce excessive alcohol consumption?
We have several emails here, too. Bill in Oregon emailed how do you estimate social desirability bias in this kind of survey, and how does Wisconsin compare to the rest of the country? Aside from people who actually don't drink, Bill says they know very few people who report their drinking accurately.
So self-reporting is always an issue, certainly, and that is definitely true. So I think one of the things about, Gallup is that we're looking at overtime, so the numbers may not be exactly accurate on the one hand in terms of the self-reporting bias, but we see what we are seeing are trends. And so people are answering differently than they have in the past. And I think that's an important point to take home here.
Yeah, I think my doctor said he doubles. If somebody says, oh, they drink, they'll have three or four a week, he, in his mind, doubles that.
I've heard that from physicians as well.
You have? Okay. Ellie in Madison emailed to ask, how does the decline in alcohol use, may not be as real as it kind of first appears, but how does that decline relate to the increase in the use of THC products? Can you talk about the regulations around that and the role of the Wisconsin Tavern League?
So, great question. What Gallup found is that it does not appear to be caused by people shifting to other substances, specifically marijuana use. So that has been fairly steady over the last 4 years and doesn't appear to be a factor whether or not people are choosing alcohol. So that's according to Gallup. So I hope that that's helpful. The Tavern League, of course, sells alcohol. We're also seeing lots of changes in terms of offering non-alcoholic beverages over time. So I think, there's areas where there's support in terms of making sure people are not driving while they're intoxicated, that we see with our retailers, including, restaurants and bars. And I think that's important.
Michael emailed to ask, should alcohol products have a health warning on the container like health warnings on cigarettes?
So the Surgeon General in January suggested that there should be a health warning on cancer. A lot of people are not aware of, drinking and the cancer link between 7 different types of cancer. And so that was suggested, and I am aware of folks across the nation that are working to see that happen. So I think labeling would be very helpful for people to understand right at point of sale, what the risks are. Because one of the things we do see with people who drink at higher levels is that they don't think it's as risky. And so that's one of the pieces, is to help make sure people understand what they're stepping into.
I'm trying to remember if I've seen, I watch TV, but I'm not watching it every minute of the day for sure. But I don't see as many. I can't remember seeing ads or public service announcements of that nature lately about drinking very much. Is there anything? What on a sort of a large scale? What can be done?
So at the federal level, of course, there can be regulations put in place about advertising. That is a voluntary piece right now in the industry, in the alcohol industry. And we do find problems with that. A few years ago with school supplies, we found emoji balls with vodka in them. You know, there's still a lot that goes on. Product placement is really important. When you see liquor right next to the candy, go to a gas station, you see lots of alcohol and liquor and beer advertising as one piece. And so that is still very much an issue. You also see it a lot in movies, right?
Yeah.
Where you're seeing that. So it, again, is normalizing a drinking culture. But I have to say, I was at a gas station yesterday, and they had no liquor displays outside their windows. And I went in and complimented them on that. So that was, you know, something I had not expected, and that's great.
Andrea noticed, emailed that one grocery store offers self-checkout lanes in their liquor section. And wonders, wouldn't that make it easier for anybody underage to buy alcohol?
Yes, that would be a concern. We require face-to-face sales in the state of Wisconsin, so that would be something we'd love to follow up on, because unless there's some ability to do age verification, that's not really supposed to happen with the self-serve.
I noticed that as well in a local grocery store. It's actually a new thing for that grocery store. So there are other people there to purchase, to take your money and so forth, but I noticed that there are several spots where anybody can just go in. Well, I don't know anybody, but people can go in and check it out on their own.
It could be that the store has some sort of protocol in place that I'm not aware of.
Yeah. It makes sense. So in the last minute or so here, what can people do? How can you be of help? And then what should people do?
So please visit our website. It's at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project, or WISAPP, W-I-S-A-P-P. And you can find us and email us, ask us questions. The other piece is don't drink every day. Mm-hmm. If you're going out, drink one less. You know, just reduce how much that you're drinking. And I love all the questions about policy. Happy to, you know, work with people on changing some of those policies so that we have a safer environment. We still have higher rates of underage drinking than the rest of the nation, and that is still a concern. Mm-hmm.
It is indeed. And so the work that you're doing can be done. It's just not the individual alone, but the way individuals can work community-wide, too.
Right.
That's the kind of support that you can provide for them.
Yes. We want to change the policy and the environment so it makes it much easier for people, you know, to not drink as much.
Well, that's, you got a big goal there. You've got a large task on your hand in Wisconsin. I think I remember reading once where we lead the nation in per capita consumption of brandy.
I believe that's still true.
It's still true. Okay. Well, Maureen, thanks so much for being with us. It went by quickly. We'll get you back and we'll do it again. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project. You can type that into a search engine. It's going to pop up. She's at, or just go to the Medical College of Wisconsin. You'll find the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project mentioned there. Click on it if you're interested in doing some work in maybe on your own or in your community to help with this issue. Coming up, our weather guys are here to talk about extreme weather events. We don't have any of those in Wisconsin, do we? Well, we're all we all know that's not true. That's next. We'll talk about those events and why they're more common, becoming more common. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. We're going to take a look at weather and climate on the show now with our weather guys. The extreme weather events that we just heard in the newscast about some concern relating to people who may have been lost in the Milwaukee flooding just a couple of weeks ago. We're going to talk about that with our weather guys, John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW. John, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be here.
And Steve Ackerman, former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW and also an emeritus professor in that same department of atmospheric and oceanic sciences.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Steve, good to have you back. Questions. What do you want to know about weather and climate? Maybe you just have a something unusual in the weather. Maybe have a general weather question or climate questions. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That was kind of really concerning news there about some folks that may have been lost. That thunderstorm 2 weeks ago, how much rain fell in that? Do you know off the top
of your head? I think officially at Mitchell Field, there was over 8 inches of rain that fell from the Saturday afternoon into the Sunday afternoon period. I think it was 9th and 10th of August or whatever. I think that's those are the days. And here to the west, it wasn't quite as dramatic, although it was one of our heaviest events of the summer, one of the top three. But it was much worse close to the lake. So Milwaukee County, Sheboygan County really got hammered from that thing.
Yeah, there were 1,800 homes destroyed or at least damaged. People living on the bridges, as the previous article was just talking about. I mean, what happens to those people?
Yeah.
I haven't heard any death numbers.
Me either. Now that, hearing the story makes me wonder why not. Maybe it's just still trying to do the accounting. But when you get that much rain in a 12-hour period, there's no place for it to go except rivers and streams and things like that, and they go over their banks. Yeah.
Last week we had somebody from Milwaukee calling in and say it had to do with food safety, and they had all their food products or many of their canned food products in the basement, and there was 5 feet of water.
Oh, yeah.
Feet of water in the basement.
Yeah. Terrible.
So what causes this kind of a deluge to happen?
Well, every summer you're going to get one or two such events, almost surely, where you get a couple of inches of rain in a 12-hour or so period, and it causes problems. Why do you go from 2 to 8? Specifically in this one case, there's no way to say that categorically now, just 2 weeks downstream from the event. It takes a lot of time and effort to analyze the particular storms that can really have these high profile impacts. And we're not at the stage where we've completed that analysis yet. But some of the factors that are around they're going to have to be in the discussion is the prolonged and persistent humidity that we had all summer long. That may not be a direct result of what's going on with the climate, but it certainly fits in nicely with a trend that would be secure in that environment. But it's probably enhanced by some sort of circulation anomaly that we'll try to explain why that it's happened this summer. But it has. We got our first couple of fall days here. This is the second one maybe in a row. But we haven't had anything like it all summer long. So that's another factor.
Yeah. Terry in Partyville has a question. May not relate directly to it, but let's go there. Terry, hi.
Hi. I listen to the weather radio, and there's a terminology on there about thermals when they talk about Lake Michigan report a thermal. I was just curious what that term, I know it has to do with waves, but why they use that term.
In the atmospheric sciences, a thermal is usually talked about in terms of reference of an upward vertical motion and a circulation pattern around that. And those are the things that people who do kite flying or sailing, air sailing, soaring, are looking for in order to stay up in the atmosphere.
Yeah. Maybe thermal anomalies. I could imagine that the lake is a little warmer than normal at this time of year because we've had so much warmth over the summer. But I don't know if that's what it might be referring to in some sort of a shorthand.
Yeah. Terry, thanks for calling. Todd in La Crosse has something.
Yes, I thank you. Kind of related to what you're talking about. I watch the weather pretty often for gardening and such, but it seems like the forecasts have been just really off this year. They'll say we're going to get an inch or two and then nothing, or else the reverse. But is there any data or studies? Like, what is it harder to predict now? Or is it more of the apps?
It's harder to predict in the sense that cuts to the National Weather Service have yielded not having the observations that we have had in the past. And so particularly in Wisconsin, there have been upper air stations which normally would, to the west of us, that normally would be measuring the atmospheric profile twice a day, and now sometimes they're only doing it once a day, if at all. And so if you don't have a good capture of what the current condition is, particularly upwind of you, doing a forecast is going to be harder, and I think there have been studies out there starting to demonstrate that it's less accurate than what it used to be. Of course, predicting an inch or so of precipitation is hard to do anyway, even if you had all the data. But I think the trends that we're seeing is you're not having that data going into the models, and therefore they're not as successful.
Yeah, and I'd say even sometimes it's outside the model realm in the sense that if you wake up on a certain day and you have a nice set of information that tells you, whoa, this is more humid than yesterday's forecast suggested it's going to be through a deeper layer. We have more to worry about an outbreak of showers this afternoon than we thought we did. And so if you don't have that information from the sounding, you can't make what's known as a nowcast, which is a 0 to 12-hour forecast with anywhere near the accuracy that you may have been able to do it had you had the information in hand. So it doesn't only affect the medium and longer range. It affects the short range. And, in fact, if I had to make a guess in the summertime, it has more of an impact on the short range. And that's, I think, what you're saying.
Yeah, because it's driven by convection loss. Yeah,
exactly right.
Precipitation.
Yeah, there you go, Todd. Thank you. Eric emailed to say, it seems that extreme weather events are becoming more common. Is there more water in the system, or is it just moving around more because there's more energy in the system? Are certain areas becoming wetter while others are becoming drier? And are both rain and drought events becoming more severe?
The first part of the question, it's a really good question, a lot of dimensions to it. As the global average temperature increases, there's a 7% increase per degree Celsius of water vapor in the atmosphere. And that doesn't sound like very much, but if you integrate it over the whole globe and you kind of have that as a trend over 50 or so years, you're going to start to notice that there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. Not all of the water vapor is instantly or routinely converted into liquid precipitation or frozen precipitation, but if you have more of it, then the processes that are acting on processing that water vapor and turning it into precipitation are going to create more precipitation. It stands to reason. And so that's one thing for sure. And I think a second aspect of the question is, it probably is true, and I think we're beginning to see this in some analyses, that there are places that are, despite that fact, becoming a little bit drier than they used to. The Southwest is one of them, and of our country. And then there's places, some other places in our country that are becoming more heavy annual precipitation totals. So it's exactly right. And that's all background climate.
Meg in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Meg.
Hi, I wonder what your guests think that scientists can learn from the upsurge in science denial, of climate denial, vaccination denial. You know, everybody's got their own do-it-your-own research to make your cure for cancer. Are there things scientists could do better to raise the public's level of nuance and understanding about how science works, that science grows and changes, and that that doesn't mean you were, you know, stupid before or lying?
Yeah, no, this is a great point. And I think we were just talking about an article in the Washington Post about a scientist who many years ago got engaged in talking about climate change and what that meant. And I think what we're seeing now is, as you point out, there's a lot of anti-science going on right now, particularly in the health area, which I think for us meteorologists and climatologists really means we need to be doing what we're doing with Larry here, is that getting out and talking to people, whether it's on the radio, television, out in the public, and letting people know what we do and where things, when publicly stated, are wrong, say that they are wrong.
Right.
The climate is warming. Anybody in the current administration that tells you that's not happening is not telling you the truth.
That's an excellent
And there's no
statement.
Data to back it up. And so they'll say it, but they won't show the data. And so the other thing I think we can do as scientists is always ask for, okay, where's the evidence that supports what it is that you're saying? Because if there's evidence, if we don't have evidence in what John and I say, we let it know, like, okay, we think this is what's happening, but we have the evidence.
In fact, the administration is actively trying to discourage continued observation of some of the things that lead us to the conclusions we have. We're not going to be sampling carbon dioxide fraction in the atmosphere on the top of Mauna Loa for the first time since 1957, or at least it's at risk. There's no good reason for that. There's a whole satellite collection of satellites that monitor the Earth's weather and climate systems, and they're going to be mothballed in some instances. And so, and the idea is, if we don't have the observations, it makes it easier to convince people of the lies that we're telling them. Mm-hmm. And so I think, though, you bring up an excellent point. We have, for far too long, coasted along doing our own jobs, which are, you know, challenging like anybody else's job, without regard for paying attention to, wait a minute, we better make sure that the public understands what it is we're trying to do. And trying is the important gerund there. We're trying to do it. We don't know that we're certain about everything, but we try really hard to be circumspect and careful. And when you have liars enter the discussion and you haven't been prepared for the lying element in the discussion, you can get caught with your pants down. And I think we're kind of scrambling to get ourselves back to where we need to be.
Meg, thanks again for calling. Margaret in Madison, your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. First of all, thank you to all three of you for this program. I really appreciate it. I guess this is similar to the last question, and it's about NOAA officials that got put on leave like about a month ago, I think. And the nickname for the incident is called Sharpiegate. Well, I was hoping for an update from the weather guys on this situation. What's going on at NOAA, and what's going on with those two NOAA officials?
I don't know what's going on with the two officials. I didn't realize they were both from NOAA, but what Sharpiegate was, for those of you who may not have remembered, is during President Trump's first term, there was a prediction from the Hurricane Center, of a hurricane that was going to go up and miss Florida. I forget which hurricane it was.
Yeah, me too.
And then Trump took a Sharpie pen and rechanged the forecast. Which is, you know, going back to the Meg's comment, that, you know, what we, many of us, did as scientists was laugh at that, you know, the absurdity of that. But this is the world we're in right now. And those two officials who did an investigation in that are now part of the retribution type campaign that you read about in the news that Trump's doing against people who opposed him. And they were being investigated. I don't know if it's been finished.
I don't know either, but there was two guys down, and I think it was the Birmingham forecast office who were under the gun, and they stood up and said, no, there's no risk at all to southern Alabama from this storm. And the president overrode it with a choppy because he knows everything. And the other thing that's interesting about NOAA is that there's just been a call for 450 new employees. They're going to hire 450 people at the National Weather Service after months ago getting rid of a tremendous amount of the National Weather Service infrastructure by putting hundreds of people out of jobs, many of them senior officials. So it's a clown show. Let's be honest. It's a clown show. And we're going to end up with a less ready weather service, at least for a period of time. Wisconsin supplies lots of really good scientists to that enterprise. We're going to do it again now. But we lost too many senior people in that exercise.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guys with us today. Questions about weather or climate, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with our guests, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Always great to have them come by and talk weather and climate. And you can join in. Weather or climate question, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Mary Kay in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay. Mary Kay, are you there? I think she had her radio turned up. Let's see if she's with us now. Mary Kay?
Yes, I have two questions. The first question I have is, when is it that the weathermen stop telling you the date and the time first thing in the morning? I kind of miss that. And the second question is, doesn't the state and federal share in the money given to hiring professional weather people so we always have weather people that comes out of our taxes?
That's a good question. I'm going to just jump to the second one, because what came to my mind immediately is the federal government does fund, you know, through NOAA, the National Weather Service, professional meteorologists that are always studying the weather and looking to predict the weather. But there's agreements and there's balances because you don't want the federal government to take over private industries. And so there's often collaborations with private industries who you will see on like local weather stations or television stations who are doing the weather reporting. And then also there's the public side, or you might think of it as the state side with regard to universities and colleges who are doing research to support improved weather forecasting. And often that's done in collaborations with NOAA and the National Weather Service.
Yeah, and I think that the sirens that are on telephone poles around the state are probably a mix of federal and state funds. They may even be mostly state funds in certain states. But as Steve says, the overall infrastructure for weather forecasting and alerting the public is a federal responsibility. Yeah,
we do have people named a state climatologist.
Yeah.
They are, and they're partially funded by the state, but mostly by the university,
yeah,
I think.
That's right. Across and all the states, in fact, there's various ways they're done, I think, as I understand it, just like you said.
And I'll put a plug in. This Wisconsin Climate Office is absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely right.
And, you know, at the end of every month or so, they put out a new climate summary of the month before. And I know John and I often return to that to see if what we remembered is correct.
Yeah, right. That's right. No, it's a great service, and it's available to the public. So,
Let's go to Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin. Hi, Vern.
Good morning. I should say good afternoon. Okay, so here's the deal. I calculated Hurricane Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, okay? And I also calculated Hurricane Maria. It would have went straight up Florida, except that Hurricane Hugo diverted its path. And like I said, I got the formulas that prove the cause of why the Earth is forming. It's forming. That's a fact. And I sent these to Joe Biden in 2021, and there's going to be a big heat wave in 2023. And the other comment on Milwaukee, they paved over, like, on 108th Street in Milwaukee, they had gravel pits. So Milwaukee Shore used to be all gravel. And when you build houses there, the water's got no place to go. It used to go right down into the ground.
Yeah, two things. I totally agree with what you're saying in with regard to flooding. As we emphasized in an earlier question, the amount of precipitation that came down. But also, as I'm interpreting what you're saying, it's also, where does that get to go?
You bet.
And right, if you have hard surfaces, that's just going to flow and gather up. And then the other thing I'll just note, Katrina, this is the 20th anniversary of
Katrina, right.
Which, again, is something I think to to note, because I think that killed over 2,000 people in terms of the flooding, what happened there.
Yep. Mm.
Thank you for calling. And again, you can join us, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Last week in your column, you have a column, newspaper column, The Weather Guys, you wrote about summer dew point temperatures.
Yeah. The one thing I don't like about summertime is the humidity, and particularly the dew points. When the dew points are high.
So what are the dew points, but just for refreshing?
Yeah. So the dew point temperatures are the temperature at which you would need to cool the air in order to form dew. And if you have a small difference between the air temperature and the dew point temperature, that means it's going to feel really humid outside. And that's what we were having recently.
When the dew point's high, like today is a good example to illustrate the counterpoint, that when the dew point temperature is low, in other words, there isn't, that testifies to a lack of water vapor in the air. You don't feel humid outside, even though the temperature might be close to it today. But when it's 75 and 74, you feel it.
Yeah.
Miserable.
And somebody had emailed us a question for the newspaper at the time about the dew point and if that was increasing or not.
Yeah.
And so there we turned to the Wisconsin State Climatology Office and asked them about it. Yeah. Have you been tracking this? And sure enough, since the 1970, we've seen an increase in the average summer dew point temperature, which makes sense, as John was saying earlier, as the air temperature goes up, the amount of water vapor that's going to be in that atmosphere is also going to go up, which means the dew point's going up.
And this year, I don't think the stats included this summer because it's too proximate. No, isn't right. that right? It'd be really interesting to see just how off the charts this summer was. My suspicion is it's way off the charts.
Yeah.
So this historical data is important.
Oh, man, yeah.
For a number of reasons. One is, just having that data and being able to do the science and to understand what's changing. And particularly as we've been looking at and trying to explain why the climate is changing, things need to hold together. And so what scientists have been saying, climatologists have been saying for many, many years is that, yes, the Earth is warming. Mm. One thing you can sit back on, and this is what was related to the email that we had gotten, if the atmosphere is warming, then shouldn't the dew point temperature also be going up?
Right.
And sure enough, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's science. Right?
And the other thing about the importance of the records, for any specific argument you're going to have, they're really important. But isn't it true, all of us, and we get it a lot from callers too, and we sometimes have to remind them that we're all guilty of this, our anecdotes are highly selective. We remember, we're all guilty of that. And so without a backbone of rigid, unmovable data, we could make all kinds of assertions and lead ourselves astray. We know people who do that. Right. We don't do that as scientists because we pay allegiance to the data.
Although the anecdotes make a good story.
Yeah, they do.
They do. They do indeed. Scott in Windsor has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Scott.
Hi, guys. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I was just wondering, whatever happened to isobars on weather maps for a predictive tool?
Isobars as a predictive tool. What are isobars?
Isobars are lines of constant pressure, so that's part of the analysis one does of raw data from a bunch of stations, either around the whole continent or, from a state. And you draw the isobars because they tell you an awful lot about they directly tell you about the distribution of pressure at about sea level. But they can tell you by some relationships that pair the isobaric distribution to winds. They can tell you about the winds, and they can tell you about whether or not a storm is close to you and so on. So that's still an important tool in the analysis and forecasting at the professional level. I think now the way that things are portrayed in weather maps in the newspapers, it's a little bit more commercial, and so they take out as much of the information as they can to make the picture less cluttered. And the isobars were prime on that list to get rid of, unfortunately, because they do tell you something informative about the weather map.
Yeah.
Scott, there you go. Thank you. Dean in Evergreen, Colorado, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi, good morning, folks. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate you guys being there every last Monday of the month, more or less. I had a follow-up with that question, though, about isobars. I wound up being a career meteorologist working in a federal government. But I grew up as a little kid looking at the New York Times weather maps, seeing isobars and cooling into the intensity of highs and lows. And that was one of the reasons I got interested in meteorology as a career. But anyway, my question's more about, this information. I'm really frustrated. I spent, as I mentioned, my career as a meteorologist on greenhouse gases and both monitoring and measuring sequestration and emissions. And it's so frustrating to see a handful, I think, of five people, three of which are not even meteorologists, re-describing our analysis of what's going on with greenhouse gases and climate change. But anyway, that aside, my son was a Wisconsin resident there, going to work at Froedtert, I guess you call it, the hospital in Western Milwaukee. So
Froedtert,
he still has
yeah.
a home there. Yeah, so he still has a home there. And so he was really nervous about that flood. But, you know, it got me wondering, you know, a lot of what we base on, especially for the folks in the insurance industry, trying to describe 100-year floods, 50-year floods or whatever. But it seems to me we have a different context now. It's not based on a historical record so much. There should be some interest, particularly by insurance companies, about projecting that maybe these 50-year or 100-year occurrences are going to happen a lot more often.
Yeah, but I still think you need that historical perspective because you need to do that statistical data analysis to try and figure out whether or not you're getting more of these, you know, 50, 100-year type events. And if you don't have that data, then it's hard to have that reference.
Yeah, but you're right that the insurance companies are asking scientists to revise those thresholds. And I'm involved in a project where we're doing some of that, actually. We're talking particularly about the encroachment of the severe weather season into the end of the winter now. It's kind of moving towards, in some places in the country, it comes earlier than it used to. And so the insurance companies are really interested in that, along with whether or not does a 50-year event still mean what it did 20 years ago. The answer is no. And so they need to know that because they have to, their books have to be ready for those events, whether they come every 50 years or every 25. But Steve's right. You have to have a standard, and revising that standard is just part of the process of being involved in analysis of data. So it's right on target about that. And your comment about the Department of Energy's climate report, I completely agree. We have a column here locally that you don't see, Dean, that we wrote about a couple of weeks ago. This report was the farthest thing from an honest assessment of our current knowledge about the climate system. And everybody in the scientific world knows it. And so we wanted to make sure that we told at least our regional readers that this is a bag job. It's not honest. And so we've done that.
Dean, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Frank in Oshkosh. Frank, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I hear and see and believe so much about the future of AI and its potential to develop new models. But I often tell people, I'll believe in AI when it can accurately forecast my weather just 6 hours from now. So my question, I guess I have two questions. One, what is it that makes it so difficult? Is it pieces of data that we don't have or can't measure that are needed for the models? So that's the first question. What makes it so difficult to model? And then the second is, are there any forecasts that you might have on when AI might crack that model and we'll have accurate forecasts? So thanks.
Thanks for calling, Frank.
Yeah, those are really good questions.
Yeah, they are.
And what's going to happen? You know, I was thinking back maybe a year or 2 years ago, someone asked a question about AI and how it might be used. And one of the things that that I still think is possible, and not just using AI at all, take the data and then forecast it, because there is physics that goes on, and that physics changes depending on what the weather was, as well as what the current surface conditions are. And so I've always been looking at it as when you take these observations, you need to simulate them to get them into an initial condition to do the forecasting. Mm. And I think there's a role for AI there. Mm-hmm. But I know I'm not the only one who thinks that, and other people are looking at AI in terms of weather forecasting.
Yeah, and what makes forecasting such a challenging prospect in the first place, I think is part of your question as well, is that you're right. We don't observe everything as comprehensively as we wish we could. And there's great promise that if we could make observations at really high resolution, both in time and space, forecasts with the current way that numerical forecast models have developed in the last 30 years, but it's been a 70-year development on the long scale, but in the last 30, they've come a long way, we'd be able to make even more accurate forecasts than we do now. But so the artificial intelligence thing might be able to help us patch that up a little bit while we await the promised day when maybe we'll have a higher resolution set of observations. Satellite information is already filling in those gaps and has been for decades, but there might be some other technologies that'll come along. So yeah, it's a difficult problem, but it's good to remember how much progress we've made on it in the last 30 or 40 years. It's incredible how accurate weather forecasts are, by and large, given how complicated the system is.
And the other thing I'll ask, of course, these weather satellites are important, but of course they're being closed down by the current administration, which is also really not good.
We're going to feel it.
And the other thing I'll say about models versus AI is that in current models, when you run those models and you get a weather forecast for a particular area or region and you don't understand it, you can kind of go back into the model and try and figure out how the heck did they come up with that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how easy that'll be with AI.
Right. I think there's one of the issues there. Yeah. And error growth within the model. It might even sound the same to the listener, but it's not quite the same. But error growth within the model is not obvious how it's treated in the artificial intelligence approaches as they stand today.
Yeah.
As they are today.
Yeah.
Mary in Mountain has an email and asks about radar-indicated tornado warnings. Mm. Are there any data tracking the number of times those actually develop into tornadoes that touch down? Mary fears they're happening so often now that people will begin to ignore them since they feel maybe the meteorologists are crying wolf.
I don't think there's a much crying wolf there. I mean, that's a very specific signal that a highly trained, technically trained person is looking at the radar, not like you and I do when we're worried about the picnic this afternoon. I mean, they're looking at a highly sophisticated radar, and they see an indication in a signal that says that's a tornado. And so they don't drop that lightly. And it is sometimes unverified only in the sense that it's in a remote area, like, say, in the Boundary Waters area of Minnesota, where there's nobody there to actually report it. Maybe even as observations trickle in a week or two later, they'll be able to verify some of them. So it's not used lightly. I wouldn't be concerned that we're going to be crying wolf. I wouldn't be concerned about that.
Another email about heat domes. What are heat domes? How do they occur? What are they kind of, and how do they occur? And did we have them here in Wisconsin this summer?
Heat domes is kind of a new, it's almost like the polar vortex. It's the summer version of the polar vortex. It's a new word. I hadn't heard it ever until about 2021. But it's not unphysical. Anticyclones, regions of high pressure, both at the surface and at upper levels, can induce sort of stationary patterns in the weather regionally. And in the summertime, a stationary pattern means you're going to get abundant sunshine for the next 15-hour day. It's going to heat things up. And the anticyclonic conditions generally promote gentle subsidence of the air, which makes the air sink and warm up. And it inhibits mixing in the vertical. So whatever you did to warm the air in the near the ground during the day, it's not going to really have a great opportunity to cool off. And so you can have oppressive heat and humidity develop over a period of days while one of these big anticyclones sits over you for so many days as that. And so I think that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about heat domes.
Yeah, it's a relatively new term. I actually looked it up in the American the AMS glossary.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's like in 2021, 22.
Oh, was that right? Started, how do you like that? Okay.
It just started appearing. Like and I suspect it came from, if you think about the television news reports, when you get this hot air, stagnant air is sitting over us, and they, you know, show that in what it looks like in the diagram. It kind of looks like a dome.
Yeah, you're underneath a terrarium cover or something. Yeah,
yeah. And so I think their use of the word in terms of explaining to the public what is going on and supporting their forecast, you know, probably creeped into our language, like many things do.
Yeah, yeah.
But is it the same as a heat wave then? Or
How about this? A heat wave might be the result of the presence of one of these heat domes because they're stationary. I think that's what the dome aspect really tries to convey is that there's a stationarity to it
they're
and it's going to last a while.
Like the Superdome.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, great to have them with us. And you can join in, too, with your own weather question or climate question. I hope you will. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. Great to have you with us today. Questions for them about weather or climate? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Charlie in Appleton emailed to follow up on the great question about countering anti-science rhetoric. You mentioned TV and radio and newspapers, which are legacy media. Are you aware of good weather science communication on social media? Charlie has searched for the weather guys on Instagram and found a bunch of accounts, but Charlie didn't think any of them are you two.
No.
Yeah, no. Actually, if you search on CIMSS, C-I-M-S-S, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, weather guys, you'll get a link because, as John had mentioned earlier, every week since like 2004, we've been doing a column for the local paper. And Maria, one of the folks up in CIMSS, she's got them all in there, all organized on a calendar and everything. So that's one way you can go and look at if you want to see what we have done. But I've stayed away from, other than that, I mean, I don't have podcasts or anything like that, but, you know, going back to that earlier question about, you know, how do we go against this, you know, this anti-science thing? I don't know. I'm just not inspired to do a podcast, but we love doing this, and this gets recorded.
Yeah, right. And I don't know.
This turns into a podcast, but on WPR.
Ah, okay. So I do podcasts.
Oh. Yeah, but we have the weekly column, and WPR is gracious enough to have us every month, so we have a couple of platforms from which we can make these statements, and we don't do it as our main thing, but if somebody pushes us around, we push back. As simple as that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fair response.
And I think we've done it and still do it based on the Wisconsin idea.
Yes, yeah, that's
what
exactly
the
correct.
Idea is about.
Exactly right.
Pete in Madison has something. Let's go there. Pete, hello.
Hello. I have this impression over many years observing July and August weather into September sometimes that's very nice here in Madison and environs. And I've sort of thought that it's because during the hurricane season, you have, I think, major low pressure in the Caribbean, mid-Atlantic, and that is sucking down high-pressure cold air in Canada, and the Northwest comes across and gives us all this beautiful, sunny, dry weather.
Well, I wouldn't count July and most of August in that, Pete. I'd say that
this year, anyway.
Yeah, you know, when you get to the last week of August, though, you might be onto something in the sense that that's about when you can expect the first night where you're a little chilly, and maybe it catches you by surprise. But then we'll have a resurgence of heat. I know it. When I have to start wearing my suit and my jacket back to class next week, it'll suddenly be 70 dew points again and temperatures in the 90s for a while, but not forever. And then by the time you get to about middle of October, it settles in for good. And actually, the nature of the weather systems that dominate the East Coast at this time of year is the Bermuda High. And it's incursions of little tropical cyclones that come along on the western flank that can be the only semblance of low pressure off the East Coast for a while at the end of the summer. So it's a little different than what you said, but we're close to the cooling Arctic here in the Great Lakes states, and so we get incursions of this cool, dry air, and who doesn't love it? It's great.
It's a nice break.
Yeah, it is.
Thanks, Pete. Glenn in Glen Arbor, Michigan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for sharing your expertise. We're at the peak of a sunspot cycle, and I'm wondering if there's any correlation with crazy weather and those 11 and 22-year cycles.
There is a correlation. I wouldn't call it crazy weather necessarily in terms of weather that's really abnormal, but I know that there were climate studies in the past that have looked at, you know, what is the global temperature, for example, and how does that line up with the sunspot cycle, the 22-year sunspot cycle, or 11-year, some think of it as. And the reason why they do that is that when you have a lot of sunspots, the temperature of the sun goes down. I think it runs that way.
I think so, yeah.
And we know that we get our energy from the sun, and so you would expect, and I think this goes back early to the 1700s, where people were starting to think that there would be a correlation. And there is, but it's not explaining the recent changes that we've been observing in the last 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like it had a heyday in the 50s and 60s studying that.
Because I think they're trying to forecast climate.
Yeah, yeah. And without other tools like we have now. And so it doesn't get as much press as it used to.
Yeah. There you go, Glenn. Thank you for calling. Joanne in Hudson, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call, and I also do very much appreciate your show. I have a question for you. My mother is 100 years old.
Congratulations.
Very sharp.
Yeah, we have some questions for you.
Yeah, right. She'd probably remember. But she swears it's much windier now than it ever used to be. Is that having to do with the climate change also?
Didn't we just look at this spring? You did, didn't you?
Yeah, and I don't remember.
I think the result was there was no substantial change, increase or decrease over. My mind is blank on the number of years. I thought it was like 50-ish years.
Yeah, I don't know if it was that long.
Okay,
I should look it up. But
it was one of our Joanne. It was one of our weekly columns. Somebody asked the question, and Steve did the research on that. And the answer was anyway. In a nutshell, no, there doesn't seem to be any discernible trend in wind speeds. And that is, of course, an observation that's taken every day by the Weather Service for any of a number of first order stations, including Madison. So we did testify to this about Madison, but so it at least not here.
So what would cause Joanne's mother to think that it's windier now?
Wisdom. And she, you know, she's in a different region. It might be true in a different region that, you know, maybe near a river valley, like you're in Hudson, I think. Was that what we heard?
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe in a river valley, things could be a little bit different. Maybe at certain times of year, it catches your mother's attention more than it does other years or other times of year. Any of a number of things. There might be a mixture of anecdote and reality in that. But at least in Madison, that's not been the case.
And I'm just been reminded by Joel or Lee or Jeff, perhaps, that your wind column was from February.
Oh, February, okay.
Of 2025.
Okay.
So there you go. Okay.
So again, if you search on that Sims Weather Guys, you'll get to it. And if you go back to February, because Maria keeps track for many, many years.
Yeah, which is really nice service.
So go to Sims.
Sims. Search on Sims.
S-I-M-M-S?
C-I-M-S-S. Weather Guys or Weather Guys UW, and it'll probably pop up at one point. Sims. Or send us an email.
Yeah, that's
and
even easier.
And we'll point you to it.
Yeah. So, Joanne, there you go. And you can show your mother that column and see
Yeah,
what
and
she...
I'm sorry my yes. memory isn't as good as your mother's.
I'm sure mine isn't. I'm sure of it.
Oh, man. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And John emailed to ask, how does the app called precip measure rainfall so accurate? Oh, I'm sorry. Let me repeat this again. I'm having trouble reading the words here. How does the app called Precip measure rainfall so accurately at the surface as well as humidity levels? It's an app called Precip, P-R-E-C-I-P, and it measures rainfall.
I don't know what the app is, but I suspect if it's an application and you don't buy your own rain gauge, what it does is it synthesizes a collection of observations from your region. People might subscribe to submit their observations, and then it creates some sort of analysis based on that. And because it's based on so many observations, it's likely that on many days after it's rained, you're going to have a pretty darn good estimate at your location of what the precipitation was, even if you don't have a gauge. And then the humidity is a cinch. It would be done the same way in terms of taking local observations and synthesizing them and then reporting them out to wherever you are in the region.
So it's going to be fairly accurate.
I would guess it's going to be pretty accurate because it's probably based on people submitting observations.
Yeah. They may tap into the Kokoros.
Yeah, there you go. I couldn't think of the name of it. You're in that.
Yeah. I know I participate in that. Where your individuals at home are using a routine rain gauge to take that measurement and then reporting it every day at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting because some days it's very uniform and easy to interpret what's going on. And other days, you know, I get 0.02 and guy across the lake's got 1.5.
So
but
it's that's
July.
Right.
That's just what happens with the convection.
Exactly right.
So what's the research going on now and in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, the main research that's going on and how funding's still there?
Well, funding situation's been a little cloudy. A couple of us, myself included, had successfully reviewed proposals to the National Aeronautic and Space Administration for various subjects. And the money had been pulled out by the hijinks this spring. So we're waiting to, otherwise we would already be funded for the research and be on our way doing it. But that's going to be delayed now. There's no simple answer to what's the new research in our field. We have 19 or 20 fabulous faculty doing all kinds of different things on this campus. So it's in our department. So for myself, I'm looking at how intense cyclones and the development of those cyclones actually work. What's going on to drive the intensity of their developments? And then ancillary questions related to that. But it's not the dominant research. There's people looking at tropical systems, the nature of the tropics, circulations, all kinds of things in our department.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're continuing.
Yeah, we're doing the best we can. We stagger forward in a difficult environment. And the university's doing its best to fill in the gaps for us. So that's probably going to help. But, you know, it's going to be tough to continue.
You know, I got to say, as someone who's retired and my research is no longer funded by the government, you know, when I hear about things that are happening in terms of cuts to National Weather Service, to NSF, to NIH, whatever, you know, in the world that I was in up on Bascom up there, you know, I mean, I just think about, oh, man, you know, how depressing is this? How hard is this? But then you come to campus and you talk to the people who are doing the research. And as John says, yeah, it's hard. And they're frustrated, I'm sure. But they're carrying on. And that's really, I find that really admiring.
Yeah, well, our interest compels us to continue to work on this stuff. We're not only interested because we're paid. In fact, it's just the opposite. We're interested in spite of the fact that we're not paid. And, you know, and so we just keep on going. We want to know about these things. And our graduate students, we want to make sure we pay them. They can't expect them to do work without it. But we're thinking about that.
John, Steve, continue the good work, and thank you both very much for being with us. Our weather guys will be back the last Monday of next month.
September.
September. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you for listening to WPR News. We've got a great group of people that do a wonderful job with this particular show. I always enjoy working with them, our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins with us today on the board. Our executive producer, of course, Jill Nadeau. And I'm Larry Mueller, and I thank you for listening. And please do stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.